Why do we cook? We cook for food, for family, and for friends. We cook to bring people together.
Mmm, honey, that looks good. Pardon my fork.
Hello and welcome to this very special episode of Pardon My Fork, Small Batch Edition, you guys. That's right. I am tired of waiting. I've had so many pitfalls and hurdles with trying to get small batch podcasts going and then barrel age podcasts. You know what? I'm tired of it. I've got so many good episodes that are recorded and I want to get them out to you guys. I think you're really going to appreciate them. So we're going to do a little trial run today for Pardon My Fork. This is a small batch edition. This is not normally what we'll do. What we'll normally do is have a small batch edition that runs on a different day. I'm leaning towards Tuesdays. Why don't you shoot me a message and let me know if that's something that works for you. And as I've discussed here on the show before, I have got a whole bunch of these episodes banked. I've got something like 10 or 12 of them. So I'm going to start folding them in like whipped egg whites. You have to fold it in. You can't just mix it in. You can't stir it in. You can't plop it in with a spoon. You got to fold it in, right? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to start folding these episodes of Small Batch in, and we're just going to have a little special Small Batch edition of Pardon My Fork that we do. So for today, we have Ardbeg Whiskey. We have Brendan McCarron from Ardbeg. He is the Director of Matured Stock. Such a cool job title. Oh my gosh. Wish I had his title, although I'm not real sure what I would do with it. But at any rate, let's go ahead and hear from Brendan right now. Brendan, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good, thank you. It's been a long day in New York City, but I am free to talk whiskey right now.
You're speaking about it with us, which I greatly appreciate. First of all, what are you doing in New York? You just hanging out, having a good time?
Oh, well, I wish, you know, because I love this city. I love America in general, so I get to come. Well, I get to come twice a year. So I work in the whiskey creation team at Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. So most of my time is in Scotland, helping to make the juice, helping to make these two amazing whiskeys. But every so often, like I say, twice a year, I get to travel to places like New York City. I've been in Philadelphia, I've been in Boston, I mean, I've been on the West Coast as well, and other trips, and I just get to come and talk a little about the whiskies that we make. And this week, really, officially with the 1st of June, which was Saturday, was Ardbeg Day. And on Ardbeg Day, we make a new whiskey every year, a new, unique, different batch. This year, it's Ardbeg Drum. And I've been out here just talking about it, you know, telling people about it, trying to bring it to life for some people, answering questions they've got, but mostly just sort of have a drink with some people, you know, share it.
I love that, man. And you know what? Before we get too deep into the whiskey, I have to say what you're doing, it sounds like a perk of the job. And you have got one of the greatest job titles I've ever heard. You are the Director of Matured Stock for Ardbeg yes. Distilling. I would kill just to have an honorary title like that. I don't think I could ever do what you do, but I just want to be able to tell people that's my title.
I love it. Yeah, it's a pretty long title. It causes a lot of confusion, but, you know, we make it work. But yeah, Head of Maturing Whiskey Stocks, it does sound pretty cool, I've got to be honest.
So what does that entail for you when you're back Scotland side? What is your job for the most part?
So in the most simple terms, I am involved, so I'm not completely responsible for, but I'm involved in all parts of making the liquid. So I work for a guy called Dr. Bill Lumsden. Dr. Bill Lumsden is probably the most famous person in single malt scotch. He's our whiskey creator. He's our director of whiskey creation and maturing stocks. So he's responsible for every single product we make, and I work for him. And I guess he hired me 5 years ago, the plan being, if everything works out, that when he steps down, I'll take over as the next whiskey creator. So the next master distiller would be the easiest term to describe it. And my job is really just learning from him how he puts whiskies together, what he does, what he doesn't do. But also my job, I have a responsibility for nosing and checking our new make spirit. I have a job for creating some of our new whiskies every so often under the guidance of Dr. Bill. I also purchase all our raw materials. I work with the distilleries and I decide what goes into each cask. I purchase all our casks. it's a real wide-ranging job, and there's several of us that do it as well, you know. It's like a real team effort.
Wow, that is fascinating. And I mean, I assume that you had some kind of experience in the distillery world before you came to work for Ardbeg.
Yes, I've been here for 5 years. So the company is called the Glenmorangie Company, and we own two distilleries, Glenmorangie and Ardbeg. I work across both. But before that, I spent 8 years working for Diageo. I joined on a graduate scheme. So my first job was in a maltings. A maltings is where you take in barley and you turn the barley into malted barley by soaking it, by germinating it, and then by drying it in a kiln. And what you're doing there is you're kind of exposing the starch that's inside the barley, which is going to break down into sugar and eventually be turned into alcohol. You're exposing it because it's covered in this kind of thick protein casing. So that used to be my job. That was my first job in the industry. Then it was a case of kind of, you know, right place, right time. And right place, right time meant that Diageo decided to build the first single malt whiskey distillery built in Scotland in 30 years. And I got pulled to be on that team. So I got put in that team because I was a chemical engineer, and they needed chemical engineers to work on this project. So I just got to work on this massively exciting, cool project. And I was, you know, 3 months in the door of the biggest whiskey maker in the world. So that was just a time to be a complete sponge and just soak up all of this knowledge that everyone else in the team had about how you make great single malt scotch. And it was an amazing year of my life. Then I worked in blending. So I was in charge of a team who disgorged, I think, over in America, you call it dumping. It's the process of taking the mature spirit out of the casks and then refilling it with new make spirit. And I did that for a year. Then I did something else. And then eventually I became the distillery manager at Oban. So I became distillery manager at Oban when I was 28. Which is a long time ago, sadly. by the time I was the youngest distillery manager at Oban, and I think I might have been the youngest distillery manager in Scotland at the time, which was cool. And then after that, after doing 2 years there, I became the group manager for Islay. So I was responsible for Kalila, Lagavulin, and Port Ellen maltings, and I did that for 3 years, and then. During that tenure, I would make, so Port Ellen, I know it's famous as a distillery, but Port Ellen Distillery closed in 1982, but we've always had the maltings, and again, I was in charge of that maltings, and I used to make heavily peated malted barley, which I would sell to 6 of the 8 distilleries on the island, including Ardbeg, and as a result of that, that's how I got to know Dr. Bill, and then eventually, 5 years ago, Dr. Bill was like, you know, why don't you come and work for me?
Wow. That is fascinating, my friend. Did you start out in chemical engineer thinking you wanted to go into distillation?
No. I'm a big believer in honesty. You know, I do hear people say, you know, when I was 4 years old, I went here with my dad or my mum and I realized whiskey was for me. And that's brilliant. That's great for them. But, you know, when I was 8 or 9 years old, I wanted to be a soccer player, you know, just like every other young boy from Glasgow in Scotland. I was determined that I was going to be a soccer player. When I went to university, I actually got really high scores in history when I was at, I think you guys call it grade school, we would call it high school. So when I was like 16, 17, so I got good results in my exams for history. So I decided I was going to do history at university until my older brother like very quickly corrected that and said, that's not for you, trust me. That's not what you want to do. So the other thing I was good at is I'm pretty good at maths and I'm pretty good at chemistry. So I went and did chemical engineering. And just like every other 17-year-old, I mean, did you know what you wanted to do when you were 17? Oh. I certainly didn't. I don't know about you.
Mm-mm. No way. No way.
Mm. So I picked that. So I did chemical engineering and, you know, for the next few years, I struggled, I'll be honest. I found it a really, really tough degree. So I wasn't thinking about what am I going to be. I was just thinking, Christ, please get me through this year. How am I going to survive year one? And then after surviving year one, how am I going to survive year two? University was like the Hunger Games for me. I barely made it out. And then when I left uni, when I left university, we call, you guys say college, we say university. When I left that, I got a job in pharmaceuticals. You know, I applied for many jobs and I got a job in pharmaceuticals. So I was making penicillin. I used to be a penicillin maker. And I did that for about a year and a half. And my girlfriend at the time, she was homesick because we were living down in the south coast of England. And she said, you know, Susan, I'm really missing home. So I went, okay, well, this is my job. You know, I need to do this, but I'll start looking up north and see if there's anything. And the ASIO were employing chemical engineers. And I applied, and luckily I got it. We moved back up the road, so I kept my girlfriend happy, and I joined Diageo, and that's kind of how it happened. And then, sure enough, after moving back up to Scotland, within 3 months, my girlfriend and I had split up. So, all for
nothing. Hey, something good came out of it, right?
Exactly. Well, actually, two things good came out of it. So something good came out of it because I got into the job that I loved and the job that I genuinely feel like was made for me. I was like, just some sort of, I don't believe in fate often, but this one. But then again, 5 years after the split up, I randomly bumped into that same girl and we're now married. So there you go. Two good things came out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. She found her husband right after you and you found your dream job.
Exactly.
And you know what?
She's married to me.
I got to be honest with you, Brandon. I'm sitting here looking at it going, you know, working in the whiskey industry and the distillation industry is not a far cry from pharmacy. So I would say that that was just kind of a hop, skip, and a jump.
Yeah, there was a lot of similarities. The thing that really helped me, that year and a half with another company kind of let me iron out the kind of, you know, the rough edges and the inexperience and the naivety. So when I joined Diageo, I really hit the ground running. I think that's why I had a pretty successful career there and kind of advanced pretty quickly and realised that malt distilling is where I wanted to be, and that's where my passion was and that's what I loved.
I love that, man. You seem like the kind of guy to me where you might not be chasing your passion, but you're always bringing it with you and it shows in your work. And I really appreciate that, by the way. So I wanted to hear all about you and your background so that my listeners can really understand, you know, we're not just talking to someone from Ardbeg. We're talking to someone that really knows the ins and outs of not just Ardbeg, but the distillation world in Scotland. So I appreciate you doing all of that.
Sure.
I want to talk about the brand Ardbeg some now. Ardbeg, the history I found fascinating. Over 200 years old right now, but really a bit older than that, right? Because Ardbeg was an operational distillery in the late 1700s, if I'm not mistaken, but of course, illegally as something could be back then, but then actually physically founded in 1815, correct?
Yeah. So the same could be said of a lot of distilleries. There's so many distilleries in Scotland that have established 1815 or established even more so, established 1816 on their documents, on their buildings and their history. They were all there before then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a fact of life that whiskey was an illicit industry. It's probably been on for thousands of years. But in the more recent terms, most of these established distilleries were born in the 1700s, Ardbeg included. But eventually, it's just like a lot of things. It's a decision of, is it worth it to be illicit, or is it worth it to go legitimate and pay the tax? Mm. The tax kept coming down. So through the 1700s, the tax was lowered and lowered and lowered. And then eventually it hit like a tipping point. It hit the tipping point. And when it hit the tipping point, everyone went, do you know what? It's much better to go legitimate than it is to keep doing this in the middle of the night, under cover of darkness. And so Ardbeg, Lafroig is also 1815, and Lagavulin, these three distilleries are right next to each other. Lagavulin became official in 1816.
That is fascinating. I did not know that they were in that close a proximity.
Oh yeah. So, first of all, you need to come to Islay. You have to go to Scotland. You absolutely have to come to Scotland and come see this place. But then you have to go to Islay and you need to dedicate the time. Getting to Islay is quite easy. It's a 10-minute flight from Glasgow. So it's an easy flight as long as the flight takes off. It's not that reliable because of the weather. But you get there, go in the summer. We always say this, go in the summer. But because we're Scottish, best of luck, you know, working out when the summer is because it changes. But you get there. a new land, and you're in this little village called Port Ellen, and that's where I used to live. I lived there for 3 years. It's an incredible place. Walk out of Port Ellen, you walk for about a mile. A mile's nothing. You know, you walk for 15, 20 minutes, and you hit Lefroig. Lefroig's right there, and you have a path that you can walk across. You stop in at Lefroig, then you get back on that path, and you walk for another half mile, something like half a mile, you hit Lagavulin. And then after Lagavulin, you walk for about another three quarters of a mile. Now, we do make you work to get to Ardbeg, because you do have to climb up a little bit of a hill. But because you climb this hill, you get this incredible view down to Ardbeg. You see Ardbeg down in the distance, and it's just stunning. It's turning into quite a hot Instagram spot for people to stop and take a picture of this just beautiful distillery. But yeah, you're like 2.5 miles from Lefroig to Ardbeg, and Lagavulin's in the middle. Three absolute icons of smoky single malt scotch, and you can throw a hat over them, really.
That's incredible. I honestly did not realize that. I mean, I'm not someone that tries to be willfully ignorant about locations and what stuff like that looks like. But what it makes me wonder is why Isla? Why was that island, or why is it even today this hub for some of the most iconic Scotch whiskies on the planet?
Yeah, so two things I think stand out more than anything else. So one is the geology or the topography or whatever the right graphy is. Isla, as an island, the fuel source on that island is peat. So mainland Scotland has lots of wood, and Scotland is a very coal-rich country, so there's lots of coal there as well. So for hundreds and thousands of years, if you needed to raise heat, which you have to when you're malting barley, you'd raise heat by burning wood, or you'd raise heat by burning coal. That's during the malting process. You soak barley in water, you let it germinate. Then you need to stop the germination. I talked about it earlier, you're revealing this starch inside the barley. You need to stop that process, otherwise you're going to lose the sugar. You're just going to end up with new barley. So in mainland, you'd use wood or you'd use coal, and that makes great barley. On Isla, there's not many trees on Isla, not many at all, and there's no coal. What there is instead is this stuff called geet. You dig peat out of the ground, and when you burn it, it creates a lot of heat. It creates huge, huge amounts of smoke. And the smoke, the heat dries the barley, and the smoke sticks to the barley. So that's one of the key things about Isla being so special, is the fact that it's so peaty, and it makes these big, iconic, smoky single malt scotches. The second thing that really plays into Isla being such a big place for this is the fact that it's tiny, but it's a reasonable size, you know, for an island. It's 30 miles by 30 miles. It's halfway between Ireland and Scotland. There's a couple of parts of the west coast of Scotland that you can reach. So it was great for smuggling. And you had a lot of illicit whiskey, and there was lots of smuggling that came out of Isla.
Okay, all right, there you go.
Yeah, so these two things just lent themselves to it. And then the rest of the reasons, I don't know. You know, it would have taken time. It just would have been favourable. Maybe it was easier to get to that island than other islands. I wouldn't be an expert in all of that. But maybe a couple of things you just can't account for. But, you know, things happened. Things happened, and I'm glad they did.
I think that people, the whole peated Scotch thing, the real peaty scotches, that is a bit of an acquired taste, but I know lots and lots of people who have never had a Scotch before. They've tried a bourbon, they're like, meh, I'm not a bourbon person, like, I'll just stick to my vodka. They try a Scotch and they go, hang on a second, this is pretty good, I like this, and then they start exploring that. As a matter of fact, I'm going to try to have a little bit of a Scotch tasting with a friend of mine after we record this episode, but before we release it. And he's that way. He just is not a big fan of most whiskeys. Rums are kind of, he's on the line with them. But he found this love of Scotch. And there's just something about that flavor that really tickles the fancy of some people. I don't know. I think it's triggering something in the brain. You know what I mean? And I would, I feel like I have enough reason to say that might be part of it, as well as people just started tasting it going, oh, wow, this is really fascinating stuff. I need to drink more of this.
Yeah, I think so. I think with Scotch whiskey, it is There's similarity through all Scotch whiskies. There's this beautiful honeyed sweetness. There's this incredible sort of texture, lightness, elegance that happens. But then you can lay on top of that other things. You can put smoke all over it. You can put sherry casks into it. So there's a great variation. But also, the one thing that I think sometimes people are turned off by bourbons or by ryes is they can be very wood forwards. And don't worry, this isn't a criticism. I'm a big bourbon drinker. But bourbons can be very wood forwards, so it can turn some people off. And then the other thing is just like a bit of chemistry. So when you mature a bourbon, the proof inside the barrel goes up. So you can end up with some pretty high strength whiskies when you're showing people American whiskey. In Scotland, because of our climate, because of our temperature, our humidity, the strength actually goes down. So the strongest Scotch you're going to get is probably about 114 proof, give or take. And you're more likely to get it between 86 and 100, something like that. I think these things help. But after that, I mean, there's big smoky Scotches. There's Highland Scotches. There's Speyside Scotches. They all have their own little variations on a theme. Sometimes people are just going to jump right in and love Ardbeg and they love it from the very first time they taste it. Other people are going to work their way up to it through blends and through Highland Scotches and through other stuff. And some people, I get it and I'm fine with it. Some people are just never going to like it. It's just too smoky for them, basically.
I'm one of those people that I never really take no for an answer, and so I just keep trying until I find something that I like. And
I love it.
Fortunately, Ardbeg is something that I like. I do have to ask, though, you were talking about the proof. I actually felt like it was a little hotter than I, not hotter, it was a little bit higher in alcohol than I had expected when I first started looking at your whiskeys. You know, 46% is pretty common, it seems. And then I'm so sorry. I'm going to butcher the name, but the Ugadal, you know, comes in at like a 54%.
Perfect.
And this one, I know that I'm going to screw up. The Corrie of Wrekin.
No, you're pretty good. Corrie of Wrekin. Corrie of Wrekin's perfect.
There we go. Okay. All right. I can do this at least part of the way.
Ugadal. Ardbeg 10. Now, if you can't get that one, I can't help you. then you go Ardbeg and O. That's a tough one to pronounce because it's spelled A-N-O-A, but it's an O because there's a peninsula on the southwest corner of Islay, and it looks like the letter O. If you look at it from above, it's kind of like a rounded off peninsula. So it's like a more rounded version of Ardbeg, hence an O. Then there's Ugadal. And it's spelled weird, so it's U-I-G-E-A-D-A-I-L, so Ugadal, but it's actually Ugadal, so it's just pronounced Ugadal, or Ugi, we all just call it Ugi for short, and then you have Corrie of Wrekin. Yeah, you pronounce them all carefully.
Well, that Corrie of Wrekin, you guys put that at 114 proof, which honestly surprised me.
Yeah, it's 114.2, so we're not messing around. That's pretty much cash strength. That's the kind of strength that an Ardbeg will come out, or a single malt Scotch, will come out of a barrel after 5 years. That's the kind of strength you'd get. So that's why we picked that 57.1.
But of course, very smooth. And I think that that's probably why you guys can get away with bottling it nearly cask strength, is because it doesn't really taste like it's that strength. You know, you can get cask strength of a lot of different things. I like Knob Creek Small Batch 120, but you know, it's 60% alcohol. And so a lot of my friends have a really hard time drinking that because it's not matured in the same way that you guys do, obviously. And there's a lot of other components there, but I was very surprised how smooth that was, considering it was 114.2. I mean, that's a pretty hot whiskey.
Yeah, that's big. That's big. I mean, don't get me wrong. The Ugadal that we do, that has a lot of sherry in it. So sherry has this kind of rounding, smoothing effect on Scotch. I kind of compare it a bit to like, it's like the vermouth in a martini. So, you know, a vermouth is going to round off the spirit that goes into a martini. Sherry, for me, does that with a Scotch. So the Ugadal, even though it's 108.4, I can drink that neat, and I really enjoy it neat. I might add water, I might add ice, but I'm going to really enjoy that neat. The Corrie of Wrekin, I'll be honest with you, is great. I really appreciate it at 57.1, but That's a drink that I always add a decent splash of water to. I just put some water in there and I'm really going to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Let it bloom, you know.
Yeah, it's going to let it bloom. Corey Brecken has quite a lot of French oak in it, and the French oak adds tannins. And it has this kind of tannic basket that goes around it. And you put a splash of water in there, it breaks that up a little. And it just sort of, you keep getting these cassis and fennel and fennel seed and star anise flavours. But once you add the water, you really start to break out the smoke. And, you know, it's an Ardbeg, that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the type of cask or barrel that it's going into, so you guys rotate a little bit. I noticed that right off the bat. I wanted to talk to you about this year's Ardbeg Day, the drum, mm-hmm. 2019. But one thing that I noticed when I was looking through your catalog is that you guys are pretty liberal with what kind of oak or what kind of barrel you put it in. And I was surprised by that.
Okay. Yeah. So the rules of Scotch are, Oh God, there's so many of them. we have a thing called the Scotch Whisky Act. It's amazing. I love it. But it's tough. You can only use 3 ingredients, malted barley, water, yeast. You have to, if you make all a single malt, it has to be made at one distillery and one distillery only. So there's no, hey, we're going to make this at Buffalo Trace. Now we're going to make it at Stitzelweller. Now we're going to make it at Heaven Hill. You can't do that with a single malt Scotch. If it's called Glenmorangie, it's always come from that one place. If it's called Ardbeg, it's always come from that one place. And then another rule is it has to be matured in oak. Oak. That's the rule. What that allows us to do is lots of things are matured in oak. So we can use virgin oak, of course. We can use ex-bourbon oak, which actually is that's the most natural fit. So 90% of the oak that you will see in the Scotch whisky industry is ex-bourbon oak. We can use ex-rye, we can use ex-sherry, we can use ex-red wines from various places. And then we can use different strains of oak. So we can use Garryana, we can use French oak, Spanish oak, Hungarian oak. I could just keep listing and listing and listing. And this is the way that you start to flex the style of the spirit that comes from your distillery.
I see. So you are allowed a lot of flexibility there. And so in order to change your flavor profiles and things, not in order to, I shouldn't say that, but you guys really have a lot of fun.
That's exactly what it is. We're just trying to create different experiences, different expressions, different flavors, mm-hmm. Primarily from using different woods. Now, sometimes we're very restricted in our style of manufacture. So we can only use barley. We can only use one distillery. We'll sometimes do experiments at the still and change the spirit character, but we also will look to change the cask profile, the maturation length, the maturation time, that's probably the same thing, the maturation style, how much sherry it has, how much wine it has. We're just always looking. We're always looking to do different things.
Well, so with your Ardbeg Day drum, I know that you release a new one every year. Do you guys change that up quite a bit every year? Do you try to kind of follow a certain formula?
Yeah, so once a year, we release a thing called an Ardbeg Day. So we call it Ardbeg Day. My throat's going again. we do an Ardbeg Day, and this year, the Ardbeg Day is called Ardbeg Drum. So every year, what we're doing is consistent, is we're releasing like a batch of different, unique, special, one-of-a-kind whiskey. So in previous years, we've done ones like Kelpie. Kelpie was done in Black Sea Oak, which was like a super salty and smoky dram. We've done Dark Cove, which was an attempt to make the darkest Ardbeg ever. It didn't really happen in terms of colour, but it made this really deep and dark and odd single malt. Last year, we did one called Ardbeg Grooves, where we really just charred the absolute life out of our casks. Some virgin oak casks, some ex-bourbon casks, and some wine casks. And this year, we've done Ardbeg Drum. And Ardbeg Drum is Ardbeg that started its life in bourbon casks. And then from about 5 years ago onwards, we've been transferring this mature whiskey and we've been switching it up into rum. We've been putting it into rum casks just to see what happens. And what you end up with is a 92-proof whiskey. That's a kind of natural fit for Ardbeg. We always look for it to be 46 ABV, 92 proof. And it's kind of like the rum and the Ardbeg are clashing they're fighting. Both of them are vying for your attention. You drink this whiskey, kind of like an old fisherman from Iowa and a pirate of the Caribbean are having a fight in your glass.
You know, I was about to say, in some ways, it makes me think pirate, absolutely, because you could have a Scottish pirate that's making his run between, you know, his home island and the Caribbean.
Aye, that's it. That's it. You got a smuggler. You got a smuggler who's an old salty dog. That's what we kind of call old fishermen in Scotland. You got this old salty dog, and then you got this pirate of the Caribbean, and they're duking it out in your glass, trying to win your attention, trying to win your love. So what you get is you get this whiskey. So up front, it's got pineapples, it's got bananas, it's got vanilla ice cream, it's got these bright tropical fruit notes. It kind of tastes almost like a tropical fruit popsicle. And then you're thinking, what's going on here? This is all these estery rum notes. And then you're thinking, this can't be an Ardbeg. And then all of a sudden it comes. You start to feel the pineapples get burnt. They start to catch fire. They start to burn on the outside. They start to turn to cinders and charcoal and ash. And then all of a sudden you realise there's maybe just a tiny bit of like a really good smoky, fruity mezcal note coming through. And then all of a sudden it's all over the top of you. You've got the smoke, the salt, the medicine of Ardbeg. It's all up in your nose. And then you take a sip and then you're back to the rum. You're back to the sweetness. You're back to the lightness. You're back to this pineapple and grapefruit kind of thing that's happening. And then again, you get charcoal, activated charcoal, distant bonfires, wood smoke, like a trip to the hospital and that kind of antiseptic flavour that you get, and then some sea salt drops onto your palate, and then you take a sip and you just go right back through that entire journey all over again. It's crazy. It's an up and down whiskey. It jumps from left to right. But it also is super big, super strong. But it also has like a disconcerting smoothness to it, something that's unusual for an Ardbeg.
It definitely makes you want to keep coming back for more. You know, I poured just a little bit last night. I'm trying to, I went and, you know, got some bottles of things because I wanted to taste everything before we talked. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here just going, I really need to be easy on this stuff because I have people that I want to take these bottles to and have them taste it and talk to them about it. And I have to admit, one of the things that I love about Ardbeg whiskeys is, man, they're a conversation starter because you're 100% right. Everything going on with this Ardbeg Day 2019, there's almost a contradiction that's happening every time you drink it and you taste it and you smell it, but it keeps you coming back for more because you're like, am I really tasting and smelling what I think I'm smelling? And so you keep coming back for the seconds, thirds, fourth, fifth.
Yeah, I totally agree. I agree. Well, actually, I don't. I agree with pretty much everything you say. There's just one thing that I have to challenge you on, and I hope you don't mind.
Please.
Take the 10-year-old, take the Ugadal, take the Anno, and take the Corrie of Reckon to your friends as conversation starters. The Ardbeg drum, take that up to your room. Don't tell anyone you have it, and just have it yourself. Because when this is gone, it's gone. So just be aware. When it's gone, it's gone. We're never going to repeat this. It's a one-off. Even if we wanted to repeat it, we can't. So you do what you want to do. But I would say, I would take the other ones as conversation starters, and I would squirrel that one away for special times.
That's fine. You know what? I'm okay with that. I'm having a lot of fun with the Anno. I get a lot of, not a lot, I shouldn't say that. Of course, everything that you would expect from an Ardbeg. But man, there's this underlying structure of dark chocolate that I get from a lot of your scotches. I'm realizing that somewhere mid palate, there's just like this 90% cacao, deep, bittersweet chocolate. And, I have to assume that that's coming mostly from the heavily charred casks, if you guys are using them. Help me out there.
Right, okay, so that's a tough one. So the reason it's a tough one is quite a lot of that is going to be coming from your palate. So what you're sensitive to, what you're going to pick up more readily than the next person is clearly this kind of chocolate and cocoa thing. The other things that are driving it is Anno has a lot of Pedro Jimenez sherry in it. So Pedro Jimenez is like the king of sherries. It's super dark, super concentrated, extra syrupy. So that is going to add a lot of raisins and chocolate to a whiskey. So that's the reason you're getting it. That's the reason you're getting it in Anno more than anything else. You'll also get it in the Ugadal because it has all the muscle shell. They're not quite as strong as the PX, but it also will add like a little bit of chocolate and a little bit of something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm moving over to Glenmorangie now, but one Glenmorangie that I recommend you get and try is going to be the brand new Glenmorangie 14-year-old Portwood. When you put port and Highland single malt scotch there, or Glenmorangie, you get this unbelievable burst of dark chocolate. So it's a bit of the sherry cask, it's a bit of the length of maturation, and the other part to the puzzle is it's a bit of your palate as well, I'm guessing, probably what you're sensitive to.
Sure, because I eat chocolate breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so that makes sense.
Okay, you should move to Scotland, you'd fit right in.
I like that. Wait, so before we started this whole thing, I told you I was going to have some beginner's questions about scotch, right?
Sure.
So I'm going to hit you with a few of those. I'm going to start right off the top with when you're doing a scotch tasting, like when I take these mm-hmm. over to a friend's house or when they come over here and we're sitting down for the tasting, what is the appropriate, not just the order that you taste them, but what I mean is how do you appropriately clear your palate and ready yourself for the next one? How can you most appreciate the second, third, fourth, fifth scotch that you're going to taste?
Yeah, so a couple of things. First one is don't get too hung up on it. Don't get too hung up on it. Some people really, really do. I mean, you're drinking it mostly for fun. You're drinking it mostly for appreciation. You're drinking it to find the differences. So don't obsess over it. Would be honestly the number zero rule because it dominates over everything else. The next thing I would advise is get the order right. So sometimes people just line them up from this one is the cheapest to this is the most expensive. That can be wrong. What I would say is younger scotches, so 10 to 12-year-olds, have got this great sweet spot of distillery character, the fermentation flavour, the DNA of the distillery, and then that matched with the wood. So they can be a good place to start. They can be fresher, brighter. And older whiskies can be more wood dominated, but in a good way, so they would be the ones to drink towards the end. That's true, but then you need to be careful. So if you have sherry casks, I would drink bourbon cask whiskey before I drank sherry cask whiskey. I would drink sherry cask whiskey before I drank port whiskey. If you're drinking a series of whiskies, I would drink non-peated whiskies first and drink peated whiskies at the end. There are a couple of good rules of thumb. But the main thing is just pour them, enjoy them. Another good one, so another rule of thumb is start with the lower proofs and work your way up to the higher proofs. But again, how do you then decide that if the lower proofs are smoked and the higher proofs aren't? There's a little bit of wiggle room in there as well. But just enjoy it. And if you drink a really strong whiskey, if you go, wow, I've maybe got the order wrong, that's a full-flavoured one right there. That's big. Just take 10 minutes. Make sure everyone has lots of water. Lots of water, lots to drink, maybe some fairly plain flavoured food, like crackers or something like that. All of this helps. But if you just give people time, say you just pour like a big Glenmorangie Signet, which is all coffee and chocolate and deep, and you go, oh, that's stronger than I thought it was going to be since my first time having it. Just take a break, drink some water, chat about it. Work it through, and then what do you know? Your palate will reset itself. You know, it's a strong thing. It knows what it's doing.
Beautifully said. I love that. Okay, next one. When you're adding water to a scotch and you're trying to find that sweet spot, what is the appropriate way to add water? And I'm going to say right off the bat, you know, most people think that you're just throwing an ice cube in and letting it melt down. And I want you to set the record straight for us.
Sure. If you like whiskey with ice, you're going to keep liking whiskey with ice, no matter what I say. If you like whiskey with water, you're going to keep liking whiskey with water, no matter what I say. And that's fine. A couple of things I would advise. So it's not an order, it's not a demand, it's just that I would recommend, is if it's your first time trying a whiskey, try it neat. Try it in its purest form, because it's your first time trying it. This could be the one that just works for you the way it is. This could be the one that is, you know, perfect in its pure form. Then, if you're going to put ice in, my advice is find the biggest ice cube you can. You want to find an ice cube that can kind of, you know, take out a ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The biggest thing you can get is going to melt slow. It's not going to over dilute your whiskey, and it's not going to freeze it down. The worst thing I see is when people put lots of tiny little sort of shavings of ice into a glass, tiny little ice cubes, and then they pour whiskey over it. And I'm like, that's going to be freezing cold, almost immediately. And it's going to dilute really quick because all these tiny bits of ice are going to melt so quickly. So the biggest bit of ice you can find is the best way for scotch, in my opinion. And it is just my opinion. If you're going to add water, water's great in whiskey. It develops it, it brings out other flavours, it just takes it to different places. Trial and error, you know, but add it slow. Add it slow, add it two drops at a time. Just use a straw, grab it, two drops at a time. See how it changes. Give it time to develop, give it time to evolve. And the last one I'd say is, if you have, you know, whatever volume of whiskey you have in a glass, I'd say you don't really want to be adding more than half of that as water. So if you have 1 ounce in a glass, you don't really want to be adding any more than half an ounce of water. Once you go beyond that, I think you're really washing out the character and you're taking away the experience, particularly with a single malt.
Perfect. Perfect. I like that straw.
The most important thing is that's advice. It's advice. It's not rules. It's not instructions. It's your whiskey. You do what you want. But they are the things that work for me and work for a lot of other people that I know and trust. Joy.
I like that advice with the straw, my friend. That makes perfect sense. And just a real quick pro tip for our listeners out there, if you're having a hard time figuring out where to find your big ice cubes or you don't want to buy the whiskey ball thingy, whatever, just grab yourself a muffin tin, fill that with water, throw it in the freezer. Those, especially those mini muffin tins, those are the perfect size to throw in a glass.
I love it. I'm going to take that one home with me myself.
My man. All right, a little terminology here, my friend.
Yeah, I'm taking that home with me, and I'm also taking some of your throat sprays and flu medications because they're much stronger here, and I need them.
You know, pack them in your suitcase, put them in between some pants, you'll be fine.
Hey, I'm telling you, I'm going to buy a cheap extra suitcase and absolutely ram it full of Robitussin and all these other things because they're much better than what I get in Scotland, and my throat is really feeling it, as you can probably hear.
I'm so sorry, my friend. I'll try not to keep you on the phone too much longer.
Oh, no, at all. Not at all.
I can't let you go just yet because I've got a few questions about terminology, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A dram.
Yes. The best definition for a dram I have ever heard was in a book by a guy called Ian A. Banks, who sadly passed away 2 or 3 years ago. He's a brilliant Scottish novelist, and he wrote a book called Raw Spirit. Raw Spirit is a book about whiskey. It's also a book about politics and about cars and about him travelling around Scotland. Kind of semi-autobiographical. And he said, what's a dram? And he asked lots of people, and the best answer he got, he says, a dram is a measure of whiskey that is equally fitting for host and hostess. And hostie, sorry. So it's an amount of whiskey that suits the person that's giving it away, and it's an amount of whiskey that suits the person who's receiving it for free. So that's a dram for me.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. That makes perfect sense now. That is incredible. I love that. Oh, my gosh. Okay. See, I'm a cheapskate, and so you're speaking this language directly to my soul.
So you've got to give up a little more than you want to, because you want to keep them happy. But at the same time, it's not too much you're giving up, so you're happy enough, and that's a dram.
That's right. That's awesome. Okay, how about a bothy quaint?
A bothy quaint? I don't even know what that is, I'll be honest. I know what a bothy is. A quaint bothy, maybe?
Maybe.
A bothy is like a little house in the Highlands of Scotland, so sometimes known as a button den. Bothy's just like one area of a little house, usually restaurants in Edinburgh and stuff like that are called bothies. I don't know what a bothy quaint is.
I read something about them being like the name for a house that was making illegal whiskies in the past.
That could be it. So yeah, it's a bothy is like a little Highland home. So these little you know, just little stone with thatched roof houses on the middle of the hills. The Boffy Quaint, yeah, that could be. It could be sometimes where they distilled.
Usually
they would do it out by the caves and stuff like that. Yeah, you could like stump me there.
How about a quake or a quaitch? How do you pronounce that?
Yeah, quake. Yeah, quake. So it's spelled Q-U-A-I-C-H is a quake. And a quake is like a little silver dish. It's not tall like a tumbler would be. It's almost like a saucer of milk that you'd serve to like a pet cat or something like that. But traditionally it was made of silver or pewter. And it was what you poured the whiskey into and you shared it. So it was a very much a sharing ceremony between people, between clans, between Scotsmen, between Scots villages, between all sorts of things. So now you get it. It's quite a ceremonial way to drink whiskey.
I love that. Should we as Americans avoid getting one of those, or would it be okay if I went out and got one?
Oh, you go nuts. You go and buy one. You go and buy one and enjoy it if you want. Absolutely. I mean, I've got a quake that's inscribed for something that I did with work, but I don't necessarily have a quake that I drink from. I think you're better. You can absolutely get yourself one, though. Absolutely get yourself one. But I would recommend more a hip flask. Hip flask is much more practical, and it holds far more whiskey, and you can seal it, so you can take it about. I'm a practical man.
I like that. All right, how about the ullage or the angel share?
Yeah, so two different things. So the ullage is when you fill a cask. If you fill a cask today and then you go, you know what, that's the wrong cask, we're going to empty it tomorrow. When you commit whiskey to a cask, you're going to lose 3% of what you fill. And that's called the ullage. And that's kind of what soaks into the barrel. It's what soaks into the wood. It's what's absorbed by the wood and not given back. The angel share is the whiskey or the mixture that you lose each year that whiskey is maturing. So some people would say, oh God, that's bad. It's actually very good because the stuff that you're losing is making the whiskey that you're keeping taste better. The angel share tends to be 2% a year. So if you have ullage, which is 3%, and then you have losses of 2% a year, after 10 years, you've lost a quarter of the contents of your cask. But the three quarters that have remained, just over three quarters that have remained, they taste way better. So that's your ullage and your angel share.
That is fascinating. I've heard those terms mixed up in the past, but you have set the record straight, and I really appreciate that.
sure, no problem.
What soaks into the wood has always been fascinating to me, and it actually, I know we were doing a little terminology thing here, but I have one more question for you because you were talking about that. And I know that the term grogging in some ways there's a similarity there. So like if you're aging a beer in a whiskey barrel, grogging means some of the beer is going to go into the wood and some of the whiskey is going to come out. And so your alcohol content will go up by a few percentage points because of that. And also, you know, whiskey left in the bottom and stuff like that. How much of the, well, we've already kind of talked about it, but is grogging really a term that you would use in the whiskey world, or is that more a term that's meant for something of lower alcohol content going into a barrel that had something of higher alcohol content?
That's not one I'm familiar with. So grogging over here is the disgusting habit of spitting in public. that's what grogging would be to a Scotsman. So yeah, that's definitely not one that I know of.
Oh my goodness. Okay. All right. Maybe that's a little bit more American distiller. My apologies.
I think so.
But the flavor intermixing when you're aging, you know, let's go back to the Ardbeg Day 2019. You are picking up a lot of those bourbon flavors. And like you were talking about before, it picked up a lot of those rum flavors as well. How much of that is you buying those barrels specifically because you want, or you know that you're going to get a certain flavor profile from a barrel that had previously had a different spirit in it?
Oh, sure. With the rum, that was kind of like a new thing. That was something that we hadn't done before with Ardbeg. It was something that we'd actually tried before, but usually tried and failed. didn't quite get it to do what we wanted. So that's more of like a, you know, like a step into the unknown, if you like. Just like going, hey, what the hell is going to happen here? Let's find out. But we had, you know, we know a bit about how wood works. We know how Ardbeg works. So if we pick like a nice, fruity, big rum, we had some confidence on how it was going to turn out. But essentially, it was taking that experiment, starting it, kicking it off, and then seeing where it ended up. With the cast that we use more often, the Pedro Jimenez, the Oloroso, the Virgin Charred Oaks, we're much more experienced in working with those, and we've got a good idea what they're going to bring at the party when we start using them. But with the rum, that's why I love working for this company. This company is obsessed with innovation. It's obsessed with experimentation. My boss is always pushing us to, you know, try new things, push. Who cares if it fails? Because if it fails once, the other nine times we're going to create something really special. And that's where the rum came out. So we had no idea where it was going to end up. We had some ideas. We had some theories. We had some, you know, hypothesis of where it was going to go. But the final product came out. Some of the hypotheses worked out. Some of them were completely wrong. But we just loved the product that came out in the end. Absolutely loved it. This is the first rum that we've really stepped out with. We do a kind of a Solera system for Anno. It's more marriage. We set up a big wooden vat, and we let that wooden vat rest the whiskey for an extra few months after it's been matured, and it creates something else, something different, something special.
You're not exactly calling it a Solera, and I noticed you're not calling it blended either. You're calling it married?
Yeah, it's married. It's married. So the actual, the blending, if you will, or the bringing together of all the casks of Ardbeg, there's not a single malt. But the bringing together takes place in one place. The marrying is the fact you leave it in a vessel for an extended period of time, and it kind of breathes, and it kind of, when it breathes, you lose a bit of alcohol, but it also integrates, it knits together, things come up, things change. It just creates something incredible.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, but it's not really a Solera, because a Solera is kind of like passing young sherry into older sherries, old sherry into younger sherries, and so on and so forth. This is more like just letting it go for 3-4 months. But it doesn't fully empty, so some of the old batch is still there when the new batch goes in. But it's not so much a Solera system, it's just more of a gathering and marrying system.
I see. I gotcha. And, you know, speaking of letting things get to know themselves and kind of sitting and, as a matter of fact, airing, do you have any thoughts on people that believe they still need to decant their whiskeys?
For me, I've got to be honest, in some things I'm a little bit on the fence, and other things I'm queer on. I don't think it's needed. I really don't. You can decant a whiskey if you want. If it looks great in a decanter, be my guest. But no, whiskey's at a higher strength. Whiskey's ready to go straight at the bottle. I think you just pour it, drink it, enjoy it. Now, if I'm doing sensory on whiskey, I'll pour it into a glass. I won't decant it, but when I pour it into the glass, I'll put like a lid on the glass, and I'll give it 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes to just sort of settle down. Then I'll start doing my sensory. But beyond that, that's all I need.
I love it, my friend. All right, I only have one more question for you. Where can people go to find more of what Ardbeg is doing, find you guys online, and find out where they can enjoy some of the events that you guys have going on?
Sure. Well, two places. If you want to see more pictures of Ardbeg, see more behind the scenes, feel free to follow me on Instagram. So I'm on MCC_Brendan, and I'm doing my best to bring to life this complicated, hard to understand category, which is Ardbeg and Glenmondry. So feel free to, you don't even need to follow me, but it's an open page and there's lots of pictures. The other place is get yourself to ardbeg.com, and when you're there, sign up and become a member of the Ardbeg Committee. You join the Ardbeg Committee, you are at the front line of information for everything Ardbeg. Everything we do is right there.
I love that, man. I'm going to run out and I'm going to sign up right now. And I encourage you guys to go out and check that out as well. We will have links to everything Ardbeg is doing underneath this episode. Brendan, I cannot thank you enough, my friend. This has been fascinating and really enlightening. So thank you for that.
Hey, I love it. Let's do it again when I don't have a cold as well. And I'll be much better, I swear.
That sounds fantastic, my friend. Thank you.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Well, that was awesome. I just cannot thank Brandon enough for coming on the show. It was a super fun time to talk to him. And I loved his description of the DRAM. I'm going to start working that into normal conversation now. The DRAM, the idea of the DRAM. I don't know. I love that. I found it fascinating. And hopefully you guys found it fascinating as well. Once again, this is a special edition of Pardon My Fork that we like to call Small Batch. So please do stay tuned for more of those. Again, I think it's going to be Tuesdays. We're still kind of working out the details, but Tuesday sounds good to me. That sounds like a good release day for us. So keep your eyes open for that. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for telling a friend. And for Brendan, this is Andy, and we will see you next time.